Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam, working on this pre-recorded program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Tuesday, December the 28th, 2021. The Sudanese Sovereign Council will begin preparations early next month for general elections, expected in July 2023.
Wada says, before conducting any election in the country, all the armed groups are supposed to be part of the political process in the country after reaching a peace agreement.
And civil servants in the Jonglei state capital, Bor, have started receiving their salary arrears, marking an end to more than 3 weeks of protests and a standoff with the state government.
So we appreciate that, and we appreciate what we have done. And we are now happy.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Sudanese Sovereign Council will begin preparations early next month for general elections expected in July 2023. Sudanese leaders say the electoral process will lead to a consolidation of a democratic transition in the country, in addition to ensuring that Sudanese citizens take part in choosing an elected government in accordance with the transitional constitution. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
The spokesperson for the Sudan Sovereign Council, Salma Abdul Jabbar, told reporters Monday the council recommended that the government begin to create awareness through the media and to provide logistic requirements and electoral materials to the Electoral Steering Committee. She says the process should begin in early January and will lead to a national election in July 2023 at the end of the current transitional period. However, Sudanese political parties have criticized the announcement, saying nobody is ready for elections at the moment. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus in Khartoum, Muhammad Wada, the leader of Sudan Ba'ath Party, says talking about the election this early will not succeed because the institutions of the transitional government are not fully established. Wada says the election required a long process, which include the registration of voters, identification of the electoral constituencies, establishment of the electoral commission and the law, and then, he says, we can now say we can begin to talk about the election. This is a long process, and I think 18 months will not even be enough to do elections, Wada says. On October 25th, Sudanese military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan accused political parties of playing a negative role in the transition, which he says would not help in achieving its objectives. He vowed to establish an independent government of technocrats and asked the political parties to prepare their people for the election. Wada says it is impossible to hold an election when there is fighting in the country and displaced people have yet to return to their homes. Wada says before conducting any election in the country, all the armed groups are supposed to be part of the political process in the country after reaching a peace agreement. This is very important. Secondly, he says, you need to make sure that all the displaced and refugees return to their locations so they can take part in the election. So if the political situation in the country deteriorates, it will be difficult to conduct any free and fair election in the country, Wada says. Sadiq Yusuf, leader of the Sudanese Communist Party, also rejected the idea of an election and instead called for a speedy effort to reform the pre-electoral process.
Up to now, there is no election law. The method, how are you going to elect
Yusuf says the ongoing demonstrations in the capital Khartoum and other towns is a clear indication that there is no conducive environment for democratic process in Sudan.
The demand in the street is no military government. We are going to court, this is a military court, and the people in the street are asking for the downfall of the military government. Going back to a democratic civilian government.
Civil activists, political parties, and resistance committees plan to organize another mass protest on this Thursday under the theme No Negotiation, No Partnership, and No Compromise, as they continue to demand for a full civilian rule in Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Civil servants in the Jonglei state capital Bor have started receiving their salary arrears, marking an end to more than 3 weeks of protests and a standoff with the state government. A committee tasked by President Salva Kiir to investigate the root causes of the protests ordered the state to pay the workers according to the new salary structure. Civil servants have welcomed the back pay. For VOA News, Dangai Dang has this report from Bor.
Atem Degak, who works for the State Agriculture Ministry, got his upgraded salary today. Atem says he and his colleagues are happy. The struggle by civil servants has succeeded.
There is no any complaint, I think. And if it continued like that anyway, there will be no complaint again. So we appreciate that and we appreciate what we have done. And we are now happy. And the laborers all over in Jonglei are happy. So there is no problem up to now.
Nathaniel Gum of the State Ministry of Gender says he too is excited about his new salary. Gum says the fight over salaries is over and the civil servants have succeeded.
Because there was doubt, all this agreement, if they can violate the resolution of the national government, so we were in fear. But today we have seen most of the ministries, they have received their money and people are now taking their money. So it is successful. And we, for me, it is okay that I have received my right. It doesn't matter whether it is helping or it is not helping, but the key thing is right belong to the owner.
Samuel Majer, Secretary General of the State Workers Trade Union, says the state government has listened to the civil servants' demands. So he has called off the strike and urges civil servants to return to work immediately. Majer says they are grateful to Kiir for doubling their salaries with additional allowances.
The issue of the salaries is over based on the agreement we made with the government. Based on that agreement, we, the other institutions is already receiving their salaries, and others is under the process is receiving their salaries. With these issues, we are decided to lifting. We are decided to lifting the strike officially. And secondly, for the civil servant, you have to report to your work and do your work as usual.
Tuong Majuk, the state's acting governor, welcomes the end of the strike and says the government is committed to work with the civil servants to avoid future crises related to salaries.
We have appreciated the step that they have taken by calling off the strike. And they said they will cooperate with the government. And the government also will cooperate with them because they are our diligent civil servant that has been working for long in these states. And when they went to the strike, it's not a crime, it's right. And a person right, a person must pursue his right in a peaceful manner, as they have done it.
During the strike, protesters paralyzed traffic by blocking the Bor airstrip and the Juba Bor highway. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding in Bor.
Human rights lawyers are accusing the South Sudan National Police Service of illegally arresting and detaining Animu Rassasi, who was nominated to the South Sudan National Legislative Assembly earlier this year. She was later dropped from the list because authorities allege she is a Uganda national. Police tried to deport Rassasi without success over the weekend after Ugandan authorities at the Aliju border crossing point denied she's a Ugandan national. Winnie Serino has the story for VOA from Juba.
Stephen Nelson, a lawyer with the Ugandan law firm Shubil, is appealing to the government of South Sudan to release Animu Rassasi. Nelson says he received a message from Rassasi on December 22nd, the day she was arrested.
I received a message from Animu that she is in incarceration in Juba. Now she was incarcerated at the border, that is in Nile. But she was deported, she was arrested by South Sudanese police. And they were trying to deport her to Uganda. So, no navigation that is not a South Sudanese. So when they reach at the border, the First Federation authorities function hard deportation. But when they attempted to discuss with the Ugandan authority to see how effective the deportation was going to be, the Ugandan authorities rejected her deportation on the ground that she is a South Sudanese because she was possessing South Sudanese citizenship documents.
Nelson says Rasasi called him on Sunday and informed him that she was under police custody. He says she has been detained for more than 48 hours without legal service, which violates the law.
Currently, I am in touch with so many human rights activists in the different parts of Africa. We are working on a petition to be served to all the intergovernmental authorities and agencies that South Sudan is a party to, so that the government of South Sudan can be able to attend to the issue of Kanini. But I think in the South Sudan, we can be able to find other avenues on how this matter can be able to be addressed.
Nelson says in October, his team filed a human rights complaint in the African Commission on Human and People's Rights after South Sudan's Directorate of Citizenship and Immigration confiscated her citizenship documents. He says the African Commission on Human and People's Rights should consider Rasasi's case early next year. Nelson says for now, South Sudan should allow Rasasi to enjoy her rights as she has the country's documents of nationality.
What I can request the government of South Sudan at the moment is to allow animal access services and investigate the matter. Because from the time they confiscated the documents of animal, they have never constituted any body to investigate the matter so that the merits of the case can be established. So what we have at the moment is an allegation that has not yet been proven.
Philip Anyang, Rasasi's lawyer in Juba, says he is in touch with her family and is waiting to meet the Director General for Nationality, Passports and Immigration to confirm that his client is in custody.
The information we're having that she was being deported, but the authorities in Uganda refused to receive her on the basis that there is no document, any official communication from South Sudan to them. And I wanted to verify that information from the Director General of DNPI Immigration, whom I believe to be holding her now. So I was to have a meeting with him this morning, and I'm still trying to work out to see if I can just bump into his office.
Brigadier General James Dark Carlo, Deputy Spokesperson and Director of the Special Protection Unit at the South Sudan National Police Service, confirms Rasasi is in police custody.
She's called Amina Rashi. She's under the custody of nationality and passport. She's safe. Actually, she's going to be handed to Embassy of Republic of Uganda. And then she will actually be deported because she has a good balance in nationality and great passport.
Nelson says with what Rasasi is going through, she is stateless. He calls on South Sudan's government to provide Rasasi with state protection as a national. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, record numbers of COVID cases put healthcare systems around the world at risk. Stay tuned.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you could swap lives for a day, who would you swap with and why?
I'll swap with our finance minister because I think he's doing a yeoman's job and I want to have a feel of what he goes through in a day.
I'll change with my dad because I love him so much. He has been there for us. I mean, like, he has taken us in good schools. He has taken care of us. Because for us, our mom is not working. We depend on our dad.
If I was to swap with someone, I feel I admire myself more than anyone in this life. And I feel I'm capable of doing what those people are doing. So I would not swap for any person.
I would like to change position with the president. Because I feel it would be nice to give instruction to everyone.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Surging coronavirus cases around the world are threatening healthcare systems in countries that are seeing a significant spread. The newest variant, Omicron, led to thousands of flight cancellations ahead of the Christmas holiday. U.S. President Joe Biden last week announced plans to send 1,000 service members to support U.S. hospital staff and plans to stockpile masks and gowns. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
More than 700 inbound, outbound, and domestic commercial flights in the United States are canceled. Sunday's news comes after airlines say they grounded thousands of flights leading up to Christmas, with reports of pilots and staff falling ill amid the surging Omicron variant of the coronavirus. But at some airports, like the one in Newark, New Jersey, it's business as usual.
I came here for a funeral, and because of the importance of the person it was, that's why I decided to travel. But I do know the risk that I'm taking, you know, flying and whatnot. But, you know, sometimes it's not about you. It's about certain things that are more important to you in life. So that's why I decided to travel, essentially. But I am aware of the risk that I'm taking by traveling during this time of year.
Health experts warn that anyone in an airport will likely come in contact with the Omicron variant. But recent reports from South Africa and England point to promising data showing surging Omicron infections as being less likely to lead to hospitalization or severe illness. Sunday on ABC's This Week, President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said that does not signal the all clear.
When you have such a high volume of new infections, it might override a real diminution in severity. So that if you have many, many, many more people with a less level of severity, that might kind of neutralize the positive effect.
Fauci praised the president's multifaceted plan to have military personnel in support roles at U.S. hospitals to help deal with surging cases, along with ramped up testing and stockpiling personal protective equipment. Still, he says, vaccination remains the single best way to prevent disease.
We're particularly worried about those who are in that unvaccinated class, that, you know, tens and tens of millions of Americans who are eligible for vaccination who've not been vaccinated. Those are the most vulnerable ones when you have a virus that is extraordinarily effective in getting to people and infecting them the way Omicron is.
Despite the looming threat of Omicron and all the canceled flights, the Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport was packed with holiday travelers last Friday, Christmas Eve.
Great, except for waiting for your bags a little longer than usual. But other than that, the flight was great, on time, so pretty good.
It was a little stressful, but we made it. We're here.
We had the first flight out this morning, so we thought we'd be okay. Worked out well.
Omicron now accounts for nearly three-quarters of all U.S. cases. According to news reports, the average number of new infections is about 165,000 per day. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
The United States is one of several Western democracies that independent rights groups say has seen an erosion of democratic institutions in recent years. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain spoke with democracy experts about what they say is causing a slide in global democratic freedoms and how to reverse it.
The world was shocked when supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to prevent Congress from certifying President Joe Biden's election victory. The scenes of mayhem inside the symbol of American democracy had a powerful negative impact, experts say, at a time when numerous studies show democracy in decline around the world. Thomas Carruthers is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Why is Brazil going backward in democracy as it is at the same time that India is going backward? Is the fact that Brazil going backward have any relationship to what's happening in Turkey or India or the United States? In general, a lot of different countries are struggling at the same time, but often for their own reasons. Now, there is a general feeling in many democracies that citizens are unhappy with what the government's been doing for them, and they're willing to support candidates who offer to disrupt the system.
A study by the Pew Research Center shows that only 17% of people in surveyed countries said U.S. democracy is worth emulating. That compares to 57% who believe it used to be a good example. Richard Weick is the director of Global Attitudes Research at Pew Research Center.
And one of the things that we see in our surveys is that people have real concerns about racial and ethnic discrimination in the United States. You know, big majority say it's either a very or somewhat serious problem. And for the most part, big majority say it's a very serious problem in the United States.
Deep divisions over race and the role of government have existed in the U.S. ever since its founding. While polarization remains, views of the U.S. internationally did improve dramatically when Joe Biden was elected to succeed Donald Trump, according to Pew's Richard Weick.
People, you know, liked Biden better than Trump. They liked his policies better than Trump. They liked to see the United States engage with the rest of the world. They like a more multilateralist approach to foreign policy from the United States. So when Biden did things like rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, rejoining the WHO, you know, those kind of policies were embraced by people in other nations.
Democracy experts say the U.S. needs to look at the root causes of people's grievances if they want to reverse the global decline in democracy. Thomas Carruthers is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Globally, I would say that, you know, as the United States looks at other countries that are struggling with democracy, it needs to think about why are citizens so angry? What makes them so unhappy? What makes them vulnerable to supporting leaders who are disruptive and anti-democratic in many cases? If they're very angry about corruption, then the United States should really press hard to help them fight corruption. If they're really angry about economic marginalization, like some people are in Peru or Chile, then you need to help them with that.
Experts say efforts to defend democracy at home and abroad will continue to be a priority and a challenge for President Biden and his administration in 2022 and beyond. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
International medical humanitarian organization Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, is calling for local integration and resettlement of refugees living in the Dadaab camp ahead of the expiration of a six-month deadline for its closure by the Kenya government. In a new report released on Tuesday, MSF calls on Kenya and its international partners to live up to the commitments made in the 2018 Global Compact on Refugees by allowing Somali refugees to integrate into Kenyan society or to allow them to be resettled abroad instead of being forced to go back to Somalia. While Dadaab is no longer the largest refugee camp in the world, it is still home to an estimated 232,900 refugees, many of whom were born in the camps. Abigail Lukwara is advocacy manager for MSF. She tells Chinedu Afor that conditions at the camp are deteriorating.
The humanitarian assistance has been going down, and most of the refugees are really struggling to make ends meet because they are confined in camps and they cannot sustain themselves because they can't seek for employment elsewhere, and they have very limited opportunities, basically. WFP reduced their food ration to 52% of the required ration.
The government of Kenya says it is still going ahead to close the camp. What are the options for those who are currently in the camp?
The first option is the voluntary repatriation, which is going to be very tricky for Somali refugees because this has been going down for quite a number of years. Like last year alone, they repatriated less than 200 people. So you can imagine a population of 200,000. So voluntary repatriation is nearly out of question for most of these Somali refugees. The other proposed solution was resettlement in third countries and complementary pathways, which also has gone down because the countries that are supposed to offer the opportunities are no longer offering the opportunities as required. They are having all their own crisis in terms of refugees from other countries as well. So there are very limited opportunities for resettlement and complementary pathways for these refugees. The third option was integration into the local community, which is a more viable solution. But this is not very clear when it comes to Somali refugees as compared to refugees who are from East African communities. So basically that leaves Somali refugees with very few options.
Are there other feasible options that you are working or talking with the government about?
We don't have other options that we are talking to the government about. The only thing we are trying to lobby and advocate for is for refugees to be given a voice on deciding what works for them. Because the solutions proposed cannot apply to everyone, considering the different categories of refugees, and their different needs. And we all know the situation in Somalia is not yet stable. There is no clear way of even continuity for care for people who are living with lifelong conditions. So the idea is the camp should not be closed. As much as we don't like the camp idea, because it's been 30 years and people cannot be living in the camp. But refugees need time to be economically empowered, to be self-reliant and to be resilient, so that now they can stand on their own. And even if they're being integrated in the community, it should be a stepwise process. So this is what we are trying to lobby for.
What are the likely consequences if the government goes ahead to close the camp and there are no options for the refugees?
This is going to leave the refugees in a more vulnerable position of exploitation from authorities, exploitation from the local community. And most of them might be forced to go back to Somalia amidst the situation that is there, which will expose them even to higher risk and creating maybe another crisis in Somalia.
What are your fears about the conditions in the camp, the uncertainty of the fate of the refugees, and the reluctance of the Kenyan government to go back on its decision to close the camp?
We all agree with Kenyan government. Camps are not a solution. What we are looking at is how can the international community partner with Kenya to provide durable solutions for refugees. And these durable solutions include having development projects for the host communities of refugees, to be able to empower the host community and the refugees to integrate within those communities. Also for Kenya to be a bit flexible with refugees, to help them move around, to do business, to seek medical care, because some of them can afford that medical care, but they are enclosed in camps and they can't move out of the camp, so they can't seek specialized care. So some of the things we are looking at is how can government at least ease on some of those restrictions they have put on refugees, so that they are not held hostage, they are not in a state of limbo, where they don't know, they don't have any plans for tomorrow, because they are in camps, they are confined in a designated area.
That's Abigail Lukwara, advocacy manager for MSF. She was speaking with my colleague Chinedu Afor from Nairobi.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linar Mudu. The World Health Organization and the Africa Centers for Disease Control say there are no drugs approved to fight COVID-19. If you have tested positive, talk to a doctor before taking any medicines. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
That's all we have for you. I'm Carol Van Dam. Thanks for allowing us into your vehicles, homes, and on your phones. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a face mask when you're in public places to protect yourself and others from coronavirus. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for COVID-19. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Ma vie, Aïcha, si tu m'aimes.